You got the seating arrangement. So any questions about the quiz? Okay. So you can bring in notes, you can open your, you can use your iPads or even your laptop if all you're doing is checking your notes on there. And I understand some of you have no opening Excel, no, obviously no using your Wi-Fi to connect up with other people in the class asking, what are you getting on question one? So that goes without saying, but might as well say it, okay? So the honor code kicks in. So no questions? Okay, so let's start with cash flows. Today, their first 20 or 30 minutes of the class will be covered by the quiz, and then we'll move into growth rates, and you can kind of relax, maybe go to sleep because it might not be covered in the quiz, at least this one. So today we're going to talk about, you know, earnings, and one of the things we're going to talk about is money-losing companies or companies where the earnings are abnormally low. And one of the tactics that analysts use when you have a money-losing company or a company with, you know, where the earnings are low is they normalize earnings. So you take a company like Boeing, 2019 was a money-losing year. But you say, look, you know, I don't think that's going to be true for the future. And one of the most common ways of normalizing earnings is to take the average earnings over the last 5 years. Okay? So I'm going to ask you a question about what your implicit valuation, we make implicit assumptions all the time. Let's see what we're implicitly assuming when we average earnings over the last 5 years and make that the normal earnings. So if you're assuming this, kind of check it off. The loss was unusual and the company has historically made money. Right? Second, the problems that caused the loss were temporary and are now gone. Third, the business has not changed in fundamental ways. You know what I mean? No new competitors are not entering, new regulations, new rules. And fourth, the company has not scaled up. In other words, it's not gone from small to large over the last 5 years. Which of those are you assuming when you just take the average earnings over the last 5 years? I think you're assuming all of them. Remember that the next time you see somebody say, I took the average earnings over the last 5 years, implicit there are all these assumptions. And if your company doesn't fit them, then you're potentially setting yourself up for a mistake. Today we're going to talk about free cash flows to equity. And this is a generic question about what happens when you get a negative free cash flow. Because when in a discounted cash flow model, you can get negative free cash flows if your CapEx, your working capital, et cetera, are huge, or you're losing money upfront. So let's say you're valuing a company and you're projecting out free cash flow to equity in the future and you're expecting negative free cash flows to equity for the next 5 years. So what kind of company must you be valuing? Probably a very, biotech actually is very strange, right? Because if next year you get approval, you could very quickly go. Any young company very early in the life cycle, you're going to have, you have negative free, it's called cash burn. VCs talk about it all the time, and they wring their hands about how terrible it is, about how much cash you burn. So you have negative free cash flow equity. You do what you're taught, you discount the free cash flow equity back today at the cost of equity, and you basically come up with the present value. Okay, so beyond the fifth year, maybe your cash flows turn positive, but you're basically discounting those negative cash flows for the first 5 years. Now, in a spreadsheet, you just do the negative cash flows, right? So if you have a negative cash flow of minus $1 billion in year one, you put the minus $1 billion, you discount it back. But what are you implicitly, again, assuming your company is going to be able to do in year one when you have a minus $1 billion free cash flow equity? What do you implicitly assume the company would be able to do? Raise new equity. Can't be debt, right? Because it's free cash flow equity. You've already covered. Raise new equity. Is that an implausible assumption? No, you could raise new equity from venture capitalists. You could raise new equity from markets. And we make this assumption all the time when we value our companies. So when I value Casper and I have negative free cash for the next 4 years, I say, you know what? They'll raise new equity to cover the... Could there be a danger in the assumption? Or put differently, is it possible that you could be right on every single one of your projections, come up with a negative $1 billion free cash flow equity, the company goes out to raise equity next year. Is it possible that markets could have shut down? If nothing else, last week should be a reminder of how quickly markets turn. And we saw this happen in 2001, where suddenly venture capital and public markets shut down. And if markets shut down, what's going to happen in year one? You're not able to raise $1 billion in free cash flow equity. You're saying we can cut costs. You're still going to be underground. And if you eventually don't have cash, you know, the most common reason for young companies to shut down is because they run out of cash and they're unable to raise cash. When we do discounted cash flow valuation of young companies, we're implicitly assuming that capital markets will stay open and accessible for the next 10 years. And there is a real chance that could not be true. So you know what we need to do to be realistic? We need to do the discounted cash flow valuation with this rosy assumption. And then we need to stop and ask a follow-up question, which is, what is the likelihood that capital markets might shut down? In which case, my company will not be around. I call this truncation risk, the risk that you will not have a year three, not that your year three numbers are wrong. And discounted cash flow valuation actually kind of blows that away. We have to bring it back into the process. We'll talk about how to do it. But it is one extra layer of concern when you're valuing young companies about the assumption you're making about capital markets staying open and accessible. So let's move back to where we were in our notes. We were talking about earnings and how reliant we are on accountants. And knowing what we know about accountants, that should make you a little nervous because you're starting with accounting numbers. And as you probably are all aware, sometimes companies don't just play with the numbers, they outright lie. So one of the questions you always have to face is, what if there's accounting malfeasance? What if there's accounting fraud? What do I do then? And I'll be quite honest, there's really very little you can do other than after the fact say, I wish I hadn't bought that stock. Okay? After every accounting scandal, and there's one every decade, every 3, 4, 5 years, where people have been holding back numbers, people say, well, I'm going to watch out for that next time. The only problem is, there's no obvious place you look. So there's an area of accounting called forensic accounting. I don't know whether you've heard of this. Forensic accounting, what forensic accountants do is they go through accounting statements looking for clues. Clues are what? That they're lying to you. So I'll send you a couple of links on forensic accounting books, which are pretty easy to read, because many of these forensic accounting books are just incredibly difficult to read. They're complex. They're written by accountants for accountants. But I'll send you a couple of easy reading books, because in a sense, they give you clues to look at. None of these clues by itself might be the one that says, hey, this company's lying. But if you look at your company and you see these clues, maybe you should start to get worried. I'll give you a couple of examples. One is, when you see income come from sources into your financial statements and you're not clear what those sources are. It's kind of this black box with a number. This was the Enron problem, where you saw lots of money coming in from special purpose entities, but you had no idea what they did. The second is when you see sales from assets kind of keep popping up, but nothing seems to be happening to your revenues. That's kind of tricky, right? When you sell off businesses, how the heck do your revenues not change? The third is when you see sudden spikes and drops in standard expense items, like SG&A is a classic number where you'll see it go from $1 billion to $3 billion to $2 billion. Somebody's playing games with you. The fourth is companies file their financial statements with the SEC. So when you have a 10K, it's filed. Do you know companies are allowed to refile if they have something in the 10K that they restate? It happens infrequently for regular healthy companies. It very seldom happens. But there are some companies where you'll see this happening over and over again. So if you go to the SEC site, you see a first 10K, then a restated 10K, and a re-restated 10K, and a re-restated. So basically, they restate. The next clue is actually something very interesting. When you look at the income statement, you're getting a measure of accrual income, right? That's your accounting income. But you could actually compute for your company what's called cash income, which comes from looking at the statement of cash flow. So basically, it's a net, the first section in the statement of cash flows. So for companies that are not playing games, these numbers go back and forth. Sometimes the accrual income will be higher, sometimes the cash income will be higher. But if you have a company where the accrual income consistently is higher than the cash income, so your statement of cash flows is giving you a very different picture than what your income statement is, hey, maybe it's time to recheck the numbers. Maybe there's some working capital games they're playing to make their numbers look better. And finally, if you look at their reported income, and this is something that most of us don't have access to. Do you know that companies in the U.S. are allowed to maintain two sets of books legally? One for reporting purposes and one for tax purposes. And in fact, there are services that track the aggregate values of the two. So you can see actually what companies collectively are reporting for reporting purposes. And what the, if you see a big gap open up between that for your company year after year, again, something to be concerned about because they might be playing tax games. So again, none of these by itself might be the deal breaker, but you're looking at a collection of clues and saying, hey, you know what, this company, maybe I should be a little more nervous about the numbers they're reporting. Now let's turn to that troublesome case. Now, how many of you are valuing money losing companies? This is not enough. You know, right? Every group has to have one. So either you don't know you're valuing the money losing company, or you don't even have any idea what I'm asking about, or you haven't picked a company. Yeah. Which means that somebody is not telling the truth. And in the interest of forensic accounting, maybe we need some forensic company analysis. If you have a money-losing company, you have a tougher challenge. And here's why. If you have a money-making company and you don't get a high enough value, and I won't even go what you mean by a high enough value, but no, you get a value and it's too low. There's an easy fix, right? Just use a higher growth rate. Your small income will become bigger. But if you have a money-losing company, don't try that. You put a higher growth rate on a negative number, it'll just get more negative. So you face a challenge. So the money-losing company, how do you fix it? If you have a money-losing company, you have to start with a question. And this question is going to sound incredibly stupid, but go along with me. The question you've got to ask is, why is my company losing money? You think that's a stupid question? It's because their expenses exceed their revenues. I know, technically, that's why you're losing money. But why is the loss occurring? And I list out five possible reasons, and these might not be complete. The first is there was something that happened last year that caused the company, a temporary problem, a strike at a factory. This year, a lot of companies, especially if you're travel-related, will report lower income or perhaps even losses because of the coronavirus. Okay? It's a problem, it's a temporary problem, but it's a problem that you believe will go away over time. Okay? The second possibility is you have a cyclical company, it's losing money because the economy is in a recession. Not because it's badly managed, badly run, or having a bad year, but because your income goes up and down. So if you have a temporary problem or your company is a cyclical company losing money because of a recession, the fix is very easy. You can basically you can normalize earnings. And you can replace the negative number with a positive number by either looking at the average income across time, like I gave you in the example, or if your company has scaled up, gone from small to large, you can look at the average margins across time. In a few sessions, I'll value Toyota in 2009. In 2009, right after the crisis, Toyota was losing money, like everybody else in the automobile business. It wasn't because Toyota was a bad company, but because the economy had basically imploded. I used a 15-year average margin for Toyota, where I looked at what they earned as a percent of revenues, applied it to revenues in 2009. I'm not saying it's overnight going to fix the problems, but I said, in valuing Toyota, it's unfair to take my last year's numbers, which are a loss, and treat that as steady state. So if you have a temporary problem, your problem is easy to fix. You can normalize earnings and move on. But if your problems come from one of three things, one is you're a young company. Casper is losing money, not because it had a bad year, because it's a young company. It's early in the life cycle. So there the problem is not going to go away next year. You've got to map out a time path for it. It could be that your company has a lot of debt, and for the moment, at least, it can't get rid of the debt. So it'll lose money, at least from a net income perspective, to equity investors. And if you can't pay down the debt, it can continue to lose money until that leverage problem goes away. Or the third is the problem could have some long-term problem that it needs to fix. What could it be? It could be that its factories are outmoded. It's got to invest money over the next 3 or 4 or 5 years to get them up to speed. Those, in all three cases, what they share in common is this loss is not going to disappear overnight. So here's what you need to do, and I'm not going to say it's easy. You got to pick what I call a target margin. You got to say, look, you got to look past the pain. Say, once this is over, what kind of margin do I expect my company to have? I know it sounds incredibly abstract and made up, but I'm going to try to value Tesla in 2016, and Tesla in 2016 was losing money. In fact, Tesla in 2020, I still have to do this, right? I've got to ask, what kind of margins will Tesla make once it gets past the pain? Leaving open the possibility that it might never get past the pain, right? Because you're losing money, you have a lot of debt, you could go bankrupt. Yeah? but you have to pick a target margin. Then you have to devise a pathway to get from where you are now to that target margin. I call this a pathway to profitability. Now, if you're incredibly optimistic about the company, it could be smooth, in which case you move pretty quickly towards your target margin. Or it could be rocky, in which case it could be slower and you lose more money for a longer period. For those of you valuing money-losing companies where the loss is not going to go away overnight, this is going to be your biggest challenge, is getting a vision or having a story for your company about how it gets from where it is today to how you think it'll look like 6, 7, 8 years from now. So if you have a money-losing company, be prepared for a little more work to get those losses to become profits. Any questions on money-losing companies? Yes. Let's go back to 2011. Why did Amazon lose money? Because it had a huge shipping subsidy cost. So you could actually see from its business model why the losses were there. It was a shipping subsidy cost. You're saying, so what? I mean, if you believe in the business model that they're building up this long-term engine by giving people free shipping and addicting them to Amazon Prime, the story you're going to tell for Amazon is essentially going to be a much more optimistic one, because over time, what's going to happen is they're going to find a way to control shipping costs, and essentially the losses are going to become profits. But if you're not upbeat about that story, you could look at Amazon in 2012 and say they're losing money, they're big shipping costs, this game can never end, in which case, when valuing Amazon, you could end up extending the pain for a much longer period. That's what I mean by story. Right now, for instance, Netflix is a cash-burning machine. Why is it a cash-burning machine? Well, this is an easy one. It spends $15 billion on content. This year, it expects to spend $15 billion on content. Now, when you value Netflix, you got to have a story about what happens at content costs. If it keeps growing, as the subscriber base keeps growing, you're going to be in deep trouble because your cash flows are going to be negative as far as the eye can see. And for some people, that's the vision they have of Netflix. They don't see how this problem gets fixed with all the competition and the fact that they've conditioned their subscribers to expect new shows every 15 minutes. I get pissed off at Netflix when I turn it on any given day and say, "Hey, there aren't at least 5 new shows. Something's going on here." And you know what? That's what they've conditioned me to expect. So if your story is that they can't get out of this treadmill, your losses are going to extend for a lot longer. You're going to have negative cash flows. So when you have a loss-making company, and with Amazon, this is why there's always been a divergence of views on the company. Those people who either look at the loss and say, "This can never go away," have always viewed it as a company that should never be worth much. Whereas other people have looked at those same losses and say, "We see the plan here. We believe in Jeff Bezos and Amazon building up." I've always called Amazon my Field of Dreams company. Remember the movie Field of Dreams? You got to watch it. Okay? Kevin Costner is the star of the movie, and he builds a baseball field in the middle of nowhere. It's Iowa, but same thing as nowhere. Okay? I'm sorry if you're from Iowa. I don't mean that in any. Actually, I mean it in a negative way. Take it. Just ignore it. Right? So he builds a baseball field in the middle of nowhere. And one of his neighbors, who happens to be a farmer who lives 5 miles away, because in the middle of nowhere, comes up and says, "Hey, why are you building a field in the middle of nowhere?" And what was Kevin's answer? One of the most famous lines in movie history: "If we build it, they will come." That's pretty much Amazon in a nutshell, right? Right from their beginning, what's the theme that they've run on? If we build it, they will come. If we build what? Revenues and customers. What's there? The profits. And we're willing to wait. I describe Amazon as a company with patience built into its DNA. I became a Prime member in 2004, the year it was introduced. You know, between 2004 and 2010, the number of Prime members stayed stagnant at about 1 million. Nothing happened, and they kept losing money. And people would say, "Are these guys crazy? They give free shipping." But they waited and waited. And finally, in 2018, not only did Amazon Prime break even, it became part of the engine that is Amazon. I describe Amazon Prime members as Amazon's disruption army. So if Amazon is a disruption machine, think of it as Genghis Khan in the corporate arena. They've got an army behind them, and they can turn the army loose on pretty much any business they go after. If you believe that story, then you can look past the loss and say, you know what? This too shall pass, and we'll end up... It's a view of the world where Amazon ends up eventually making money. So I'm not saying any of these are easy or that there's a path that that everybody's going to pick. But the reason we invest is you have buyers and sellers. You have people who have upbeat stories and people who have downbeat stories. And when you look at your company, make your choice and have enough faith to hold on. Okay? Do you see when I talked about faith at the start of the class, it sounded abstract. Last week, what was the market doing every evening? Or all through the day if you kept checking it? It was knocking on it. Do you still have faith? What the hell are you doing? Doing intrinsic valuation. Look at what we're doing here. We're going crazy. That's what I meant by faith. And that's something we all have to go through on our own and make our own decisions as whether we still have faith. So now let's talk about taxes. Yes?
In a way, the faith can be translated into some kind of a network effect?
Faith can be translated into I have no idea what you mean. What order you're talking about?
What's happening with Amazon? Like,
yeah.
People will come eventually. What you're talking
about. So we're talking about Amazon, not the market last week. No, right. Yeah. Okay, we're talking about Amazon. Yeah. It could be that it could be a network effect in the sense the more people who gather in Amazon, the more likely it is that other people join them. It's a tough argument to make. If you make it as a retail business, there's no reason for you to shop. It's not like ride sharing, where later on I'll talk. There's a networking benefit. But your story could draw on all kinds of reasons with Amazon. But ultimately, in all of those, you have to make your small profits into big profits. So let's talk about tax rates. So you've gone through the dance, you come up with an operating income, and you're saying, remember that you have to multiply the operating income by 1 minus T. So I want to talk about that tax rate. Now, when we talked about cost of debt, we talked about an after-tax cost of debt. And there, the rule on tax rates is very direct and very clear. What tax rate do we use when you compute after-tax cost of debt? It's always a marginal tax rate. No ifs, buts, no maybes. It's always a marginal tax rate. The reason being is very simple. Interest saves you taxes at the margin, so we use the marginal tax rate. Now I'm going to ask you the question, but in a different context. You've now computed the operating income for your company for the next 10 years. You have to ask yourself, what 1 minus T do I use? What tax rate? And I'll give you the choices. You can use the effective tax rate, which is just taxes paid divided by taxable income in your accrual income statement. That's what the definition of effective tax rate is. You could divide the taxes paid by the EBIT, the actual cash taxes paid. Okay? You could use the marginal tax rate for the country in which the company operates. You could use the average marginal tax rate across all of the countries in which this company operates. If you have a company like Coca-Cola, it could be in 15 different countries. Maybe it's none of the above. And maybe the last answer would be really good if it were true. Maybe you can use any of the above as long as you stay consistent. If the last answer were true, what tax rate would we use in valuation? What's the easiest tax rate to work with? Zero. So clearly that can't be true, so let's knock off the last choice. So really it boils down to, do you want to use an effective tax rate, a marginal tax rate, or some cash tax rate you compute by dividing actual taxes paid by EBIT? What do you think? Anybody want to give it a shot? Effective, marginal.
Effective.
You think effective? Okay, tell me why. Okay, but let me ask you a question. Why then effective tax rate here and marginal tax? Couldn't I use the same argument for cost of debt? Why am I using marginal tax rate there and effective tax rate here? Because you're going to get asked this question. Because you do a DCF valuation, use a marginal tax rate when you do your cost of debt, and an effective tax rate when you do your income, you're going to be asked to explain what seems like a contradiction. Yes. Absolutely. You've got the reason. So when you get into this fight with whoever the other people in your group are, here's the rationale. Interest saves you taxes at the margin, right? So you get $100 million, you subtract it out, the last $100 million. This is the tax rate you're computing on all of your income, which means it's got to be something that you pay in all of your income. But let me follow up there. Let's take a typical U.S. company. Typical U.S. company has a 25% marginal tax rate now and an effective tax rate of, let's say, 18%, 17%, maybe even 16%. So I'm going to take the 16%, apply it in my operating income next year. And what's my excuse going to be? Well, because that's my effective. And why are my effective tax rates lower than my marginal tax rates? It's either because I'm deferring taxes or because I have income in other locations, right? Then I do this in year two. Then I'm doing this in year three. Then I'm doing it in year four. And then year five. And then I get to year 10 and I keep doing it. I leave the effective tax rate at 16%. Could I get into trouble? What am I doing when I do that? Especially if I'm deferring taxes. I have a really good tax accountant and a tax lawyer. I'm deferring taxes to future years. That's why my effect. Because remember, when you talk about corporations, it's not brackets, different brackets. Everybody pretty much hits the top bracket around 5 million. So all big companies pretty much are paying the high, should be paying the highest margin tax rate. It must be because you're deferring taxes. If you're deferring taxes and you keep using the effective tax rate forever, you're essentially assuming what about tax defer? That you can keep deferring taxes forever and it'll never catch up with you. And if you believe that, there's a padded cell in a federal penitentiary waiting for you because you can't keep deferring taxes forever. You know when it starts to catch up with you? As your growth starts to level off. High growth companies, and if you don't believe me, take a look at many of the high growth companies will have much lower effective than marginal tax rates because growth gives you ways to play the tax game. As your growth starts to level off, your effective tax rate starts to creep towards your marginal tax rate. So let me ask you the question again. Keeping in mind that you're not stuck with one tax rate to use all through the life of your cash flows, what tax rate should you use to get your cash flows? Up front, you want to use the effective tax rate, then go use the effective tax rate. But as you move towards your terminal year, you know what you should be trying to do with your tax rate? Start to move towards your marginal tax rate. It's the safest place to be when you get to the marginal, when you get to the terminal value. Because there, you're going to lock that tax rate in forever. So if you leave open that possibility, the right answer to that question is, you can use both the effective and the marginal. Effective to get started, marginal is your end game. One of the nice things about the U.S. tax code changing in 2017 is the marginal tax rate globally has converged around 25%. So whether you operate in Europe, U.S., you know, much of the rest of the world, 25%. So now when I value global multinational companies, it's made my life easier because I no longer have to ask, will that marginal tax rate be the U.S. marginal tax rate? The global marginal average is close to 25%. That's why if you look at all my DCFs that I've done so far already, the Heineken and the Apple, Heineken and Tesla, you'd see my tax rates converging on 25% in year 10. Any questions about taxes? Yes. Oh, don't even play games. Just make it as easy as you can on yourself. So I'll just use straight lines. So the question was, I need to get from 20 to 25, and I, you know, you can try fancy ways of doing it. I'd go 21, 22, 23, 24, 25 over 5 years and just let it play. Because ultimately, it's not affecting value very much. In fact, in general, don't get complicated about adjustment processes because the starting and the ending number matter a lot more than how you get from the bottom to the top. So I would just make it just linear steps. Now let's talk about money-losing companies. And one more loose end on taxes before we move on. Let's say you're looking at a company which has $1 billion in net operating loss. You know, companies lose money. They don't pay taxes. But it doesn't stop there. They don't pay taxes, but they're allowed to keep track of their losses and move them across time. And when they start making money, they can use the NOL to offset the income. The U.S. tax law used to put restrictions on how far you could carry your NOLs forward, like 7 years forward, 5 years back. I think you can carry them forward because what the IRS discovered was if you didn't get to claim the NOL within 7 years, you were bankrupt anyway. So why are we keeping track of this? So you can carry losses forward as you go through. So let's take this company. It's got $1 billion in NOLs from previous losses. It's now finally turned the corner, and you expect it to make $500 million in operating income every year for the next 3 years. It's a very easy problem. I just want to make sure that you deal with NOLs correctly. So in year one, how much should I pay in taxes? Zero, right? Because I have an NOL, it's going to produce. In year two again? Zero. In year three? Remember, the NOL is now gone. So one of the things about NOLs is not only do you have to keep track of them, you have to keep track of how much you're using up. And when you've run out of them, you're essentially going to have to pay your full taxes. Those of you valuing money-losing companies, here's another headache you'll have to deal with. If you have a money-losing company, and it's a money-losing company like Casper, remember, Casper has never made money in its lifetime. Coming into the valuation, you already come in with an NOL, right? So you look at the prospectus for Uber, Casper, they already come in with an NOL. And for the first 3 years, if you expect them to keep losing money, the NOL will get bigger. So you have to have that. No, it's not a big deal. You just have to keep track of it. And in year four, if they start to make money, you got to use the NOL. It's the healthiest way of incorporating NOLs into valuation. You're saying, what are the unhealthy ways? A lot of people valuing companies with NOLs value the company as if there's no NOL. And then after they're done with the valuation, they try to bring the NOL in, and they play all kinds of silly games. They multiply the NOL by the tax rate, saying, I'm going to get the entire tax benefit. But that's not really true, right? Because NOLs don't work that way. The IRS doesn't mail you a check for the tax rate times the NOL. You got to make money to cover that NOL. So there's a time value of money you've got to worry about. There's a risk that you might never make money. And by discount, putting it into my cash flows, which is what this is going to do, and discounting back at the cost of capital, I take care of both those problems. I've factored in the time value that I have to wait to get the tax benefits, and I've also factored in the fact that my operating income is unpredictable. So any last questions about taxes before we move on? Some of you are valuing companies in tax-free locations. Enjoy the moment while it lasts. But you have zero taxes. Don't look a gift horse in the mouth saying, no, should I put a tax rate? A tax rate of zero is a tax of zero. So basically, let it go, right? But if you are making money in any tax making, no, you have to pay tax and you've got to factor it into your valuation. So we've got EBIT times 1 minus T. It took us a while to get there. Let's talk about net capital expenditures. Again, rather than get caught up in the accounting definitions, I'm going to tell you what I'm trying to capture with net capex. Net capex is what I'm putting into my long-term assets to create future growth. Of course, if I am a manufacturing company, those long-term assets might be factories and plant and equipment and what I'm spending. But if I'm a technology company, my net capex should include R&D. If I'm a consulting firm, it could include recruiting and training expenses, something we talked about in that test from last session. So when we talk about net capex, here's the basic idea that you have to keep in mind. The net capex assumptions you make have to be linked up to what you're assuming about future growth. So in your spreadsheet, you can't let these two line items become separate line items, because I can promise you that the following will happen. After you're done with the evaluation, you go change one of the line items. Let's take the growth rate, and you decide to double the growth rate. And if you're not careful and you leave your net capex as is, you know what you're going to find, right? Your company's worth a lot more. Why? Because you've magically been able to create growth without reinvesting. So you've got to connect the two. We're going to talk about ways of connecting the two. One you've already seen, where I've taken your revenues and tied it to your invested capital, the sales invested capital. But you got to tie the two assumptions together. So let's take a closer look at what goes into net capex. If you look at the accounting definition, it's very simple, right? You go to the statement of cash flows, there's a capex line item, there's a depreciation line item, you take the difference, you got net capex. But don't stop there. We already talked about R&D, right? R&D is a capex, you got to affect, so your net capex will be affected by the capitalization of R&D. It's going to go up. But that's not all you have to factor in. If a company, net capex is what you invest in to grow, then an acquisition you make is part of net capex. So Morgan Stanley, just a few weeks ago, made a $13 billion net capex in buying E-Trade. Yeah. When you decide to make an acquisition, it becomes part of your net capex as well. So my definition of net capex is going to be much broader than what you see in the statement of cash flows, because I'm going to try to capture whatever you invest. Incidentally, I don't care whether your acquisitions, you pay with cash or stock. In fact, this is a general principle to use here. Just because a company uses shares to pay for something doesn't mean it's evaded the cash flow requirement. Whether that those shares are given as compensation or whether used in an acquisition, because all you've done is skipped a step, right? You know what I mean by skipped a step? If you've taken those shares, issued them to the market, taken the cash and paid for the acquisition, we'd have treated it as a cash acquisition. Used a barter system to evade cash flows. I'm going to count all acquisitions, whether they're paid for with stock or cash, in my valuation. So let's take an example. You're familiar with Cisco. It's been around a while now. But in the 1990s, Cisco was the wonder stock. It was the Tesla of that decade. It started in 1990 worth $4 billion. And by 1999, it was worth $400 billion. For a brief period in 1999, it was actually the most valuable company in the world. And it did it by acquiring other companies. Its modus operandi for growth was not to take projects and have an internal R&D, but to wait for a small company to come up with a promising product, and they would buy the company with the product and essentially convert it to commercial use. They were masters at converting promising technologies to commercial use. So if you're looking at Cisco and they're growing by acquisitions, it's unrealistic to act like they're not doing acquisitions. So in 1999, for instance, they bought nine companies. You think, what the heck is a method of acquisition? Pre-1999, in the US, there were two ways you could account for an acquisition. The first was called purchase accounting, which looks very much like the accounting today. You bought the company, you showed goodwill on your balance sheet. Essentially, it looks like acquisition accounting today. But there was a second way companies were allowed to use, where if they paid with shares, they were allowed to use what's called pooling. And the advantage of pooling for companies is they didn't have to show goodwill on the balance sheet. They basically could just say, look, it was paid with the share. It was a terrible practice because it allowed companies to kind of hide their acquisitions. But already you can see three of the biggest acquisitions Cisco did, they paid with shares. Six, they paid with cash. Collectively, what they paid for all of these acquisitions was about $2.5 billion. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to treat that $2.5 billion as huge capex for Cisco in 1999. My net capex for Cisco started with looking at the accounting numbers. So if you start with just the statement of cash flow numbers, I'd have stopped with $98 million. But I first adjusted for R&D, doing what I did for SAP last session. I capitalized the R&D, which increases my net capex by another $1.1 billion. And then if you add acquisitions, my total net capex at Cisco, counting with this much broader definition of CapEx, is almost $3.7 billion. Am I punishing Cisco or helping it by doing this? Actually, the answer is neither yet. It is going to lower my cash flows. My cash flow is going to be negative right now because, so that's the bad news, right? You know what the good news is going to be? What did I say growth was going to be connected to? How much you reinvest. So when I give them a growth rate, I'm going to give them a much higher growth rate as well. The net effect will be determined by whether their acquisitions were sensible, whether they're buying things at a low enough price. So you're not punishing or rewarding companies by counting all of this net capex. That's going to show up later when we talk about what kind of growth comes out of those investments. So any questions on the net capex? Yes. It already, in fact, the goodwill part gets amortized, but it used to be it got amortized just like R&D over a period of time, pre-2000 and something. You know how it's done now, right? It stays on, and it's make work for accountants day. Because every year, you know what the accountants have to do, and this has to be an external accounting firm, Deloitte, Ernst & Young, somebody will come in, and they will check your goodwill by doing what? By doing a little kabuki dance and saying, it looks high, it looks low. And then if it's too high, you know what they have to do, right? They have to impair the goodwill. So the amortization of goodwill has now been replaced with this kind of discontinuous process where nothing could happen to it or could get impaired. The amortization of goodwill used to be a non-entity because it was not tax deductible in the first place. Same thing with impairment of goodwill. So with acquisitions now, that amortization process has become both more murky and less, you don't care from a cash flow perspective. So with acquisitions, you can ignore the cash flow part, at least from the amortization or the impairment, because you're not going to get a tax benefit on that. Okay? Any other questions? Now, the one challenge with acquisition, if a company goes through acquisition, your life gets a lot more difficult, right? Because it's not going to be on the statement of cash flows if you pay with shares. You actually have to check the footnotes. And it's going to be lumpy. You know what I mean by lumpy? Where you're going to have some years where you spend a lot on acquisitions and other years you don't. So you've got to look across time. You can't just look at the most recent year and extrapolate, because God only knows what the most recent year looked like. Yes?
That's
why holding company valuations top down are almost useless, right? If you try to value SoftBank from the top down, you get this nonsensical number, because ultimately it is a collection. It's like valuing a mutual fund as a collection of holdings, but not looking at the individual numbers. So when you have a holding company and you can see this, the only way to get a good valuation of a holding company is to actually value the subsidiaries, at least the big ones, on your own, which is a pain in the neck if they have 15 subsidiaries. But that's the reality you face with a SoftBank. You need to value WeWork and actually make a judgment of whether it's worth nothing or the $6 billion they claim it is. But I think with holding companies, there's no way around that problem. Let's talk about working capital. Since we're messing up accounting definitions, let's keep going. What's your accounting definition of working capital? Come on. Current assets minus current liabilities, right? It's as old as accounting. That's not the definition we should be using in valuation. In valuation, when you talk about working capital, it's a difference between non-cash current assets and non-debt current liabilities. Let me take the easier half of that equation. When you look at the current liabilities of a company in a balance sheet, you'd see accounts payable, supplier credit, but you'd also see short-term debt, short-term portion of long-term debt. You know what you should be doing with that? You should be taking that debt out of the current liabilities, treating it as debt when you do cost of capital, attaching a long-term cost and moving on. So you cannot count something both in your cost of capital. So you take the debt out of working capital because it's already being treated as part of your cost of capital calculation. That's easy. Let's turn to the other side. Non-cash current assets. This might sound like penny change. You think, who cares? Can you see the difference between Apple's working capital computed the conventional way and Apple's working capital without cash? It's going to be $250 billion lower, right? So this is a huge choice that I'm making. So let's talk about why we take cash out of working capital. In fact, the best way to talk about why we take cash out of working capital is to talk about why we leave inventory and accounts receivable in working capital. You run a small store, and you go into your storeroom, and it's filled to the top with inventory. In other words, you've been stocking up an inventory like it's going to go out of style. Why should you be concerned? What's the problem with having that much inventory? That's a big problem if it's losing value. But it's even if it's not losing value, it's a wasting asset, right? While it sits on the shelf, it doesn't make you any money. It ties up your cash. If you sell items on credit and you don't charge interest, again, you're tying up cash. That's why when you increase inventory, it drains your cash flows. When you increase your accounts payable, accounts receivable, it decreases your cash flows. So the question we face with cash is cash a wasting asset? Or let me rephrase the question. What has to be true for cash to be a wasting asset? Come on. If it doesn't earn enough interest relative to what? Short-term or long-term? Okay. We're getting closer. So if I told you Google has $120 billion invested at 1%, it sounds like a terrible investment, right? 1%. But here's a question I would have for you, and maybe you can check your brokerage account from last year. I'm just doing my taxes, and I'm checking my brokerage account. One of the things they report is the interest income I made last year on my cash, and it made me weep. Because you know what I earned as an interest income? like 0.3%, 0.5%. So when you look at a company with a big cash balance earning 1%, your first inclination might be, hey, that's terrible because you're comparing that number to a cost of equity or capital, but that's not fair, right? It's liquid and it's riskless, and right now if you're investing in something liquid or riskless, you're going to make about 1%. Cash is not a wasting asset if it's invested in commercial paper and T-bills. It's earning exactly what it should be earning. You might not like that number, but it's not destroying value. That's why with Apple and with Google, I'm not counting the $250 billion in cash. It's not because, in fact, one of the biggest wastes of time in valuation, when people start arguing, is it operating cash or non-operating cash? My response is, I don't care. Because some companies do need operating cash, right? Like Walmart. You're a retailer, you need cash in the tills to pay change for people who pay with cash. But even if you have operating cash, if that cash is invested in something risk-free while it's part of your operations, I'm not going to count it as cash in my working capital. So now let me ask you a question. What would have to be true for cash to be included in working capital? It's got to be a wasting asset, right? And what makes cash a wasting asset? If you have a lot of cash and it's sitting in a checking account, you have a $150 billion cash balance, you're making a bank very happy with what you're doing. But if you're the CFO of this company, you really shouldn't be a CFO. I don't know whether you should even be holding any position because you've just wasted cash. The only scenarios we'd count cash as part of working capital is that cash is sitting around in stack. You'd have to run some kind of illegal business where you need to pay with a lot of cash, then maybe you can say count cash as part of working capital. But otherwise, it makes absolutely no sense to count cash as working capital. So be prepared for that discussion again of operating cash versus non-operating cash, and be ready to counter with saying, is it wasting or non-wasting cash? Because that's really the divide that determines what should be in working capital. So here are some general propositions about working capital. Remember early on in this class, I talked about the fact that I've never broken working capital down into its constituent parts, accounts receivable. It's not because you can't do it, but if I am bringing nothing to the table by breaking working capital down, why bother? So if you're valuing a company and you really have insights, you think this company is going to reduce its inventory by 50% over the next 3 years, then by all means, break it down. But otherwise, just compute one aggregated number. Second, working capital is the change in working capital, which is what affects your cash flow, is one of the most volatile numbers in valuation. What I mean by that is in some years it'll increase by $1 billion, other years it'll decrease by $1 billion. So don't take last year's change and make that the basis for your projections. At least look at a couple of years, 3, 4, 5 years, to make the judgment. And be prepared for a surprise. If your accounting training has taught you that working capital is always a positive number, it drains cash flows, your company could have negative working capital. About a third of all U.S. companies last year had negative working capital. What does that mean? Your non-debt current liabilities were actually greater than your non-cash current assets. And it creates an interesting issue because if you have negative working capital and you grow and the working capital gets more negative, guess what working capital becomes? It becomes a source of cash flows. The more you grow, the higher the cash flows you get from working capital. Okay? And in a sense, this has become more common because people stopped taking accounting rules for given and started thinking for themselves. When I took accounting, I was taught that a healthy company should have a current ratio of 2. Do they still teach that crap? I mean, that current assets should be twice current liabilities. It's absurd. It makes no sense. And Walmart came along and said, why? And they said, because that's the way it's always been. And Walmart said, that costs us billions of dollars to keep inventory. So Walmart started on this venture of trying to maintain controls on inventory. So by using, you know, by scanning things, making sure the inventory didn't build up, and making their manufacturers and suppliers carry inventory because they wanted to bring inventory down. And they succeeded. They actually made non-cash working capital close to zero. If you're a retailer and you can make non-cash working capital a neutral item, it's a huge plus for your cash flows because think of how much money you save. You take a company like Walmart with $400 billion in revenues. Let's say typically you need to carry 2% of revenues in non-cash working capital because that's what other retailers do. That's a $4 billion cash flow. If you carry nothing, that's $4 billion saved. And once Walmart did that, it became a pattern that all the box stores do. So you look at a Costco, you look at a Sam's Club, you basically see the same model played out. And as with everything else, Amazon took that model and took it to the next level. Right from the beginning. One of the things that Amazon did early in its life that threw people off is it was a traditional retailer selling stuff online, but it consistently had a negative working capital. And here's why. It actually got suppliers and distributors to sell items to it on credit. So it basically got accounts payable. It collected, it had very little inventory. Why? Because they said, you order and then we'll tell you whether we have it. So basically, they don't maintain what I call show inventory. They had very low inventory. So they actually ended up with negative working capital. They actually ended up with the non-cash current assets being less than non-debt current liabilities, which allowed them as they grew to use supplier credit as a source of capital, because that's effectively what you're doing. So when you look at negative working capital, it might not be an aberration. It just might be a reflection of a business model. Yeah. You could, and that's actually the trade-off, right? That's actually because people looked at Amazon, and every company now wants to be like Amazon. So guess what they do? They all adopted this model saying, what could go wrong? And you can see what can go wrong, because we consistently keep using supplier credit to grow. Supplier credit becomes this really big number. In good times, nobody notices. But in bad times, your suppliers notice first, and then your creditors start to notice. So eventually, your debt rating drops. So that's the trade-off. With these models, you get much higher default risk. And if you're not careful, the model can blow up on you. And I've seen, you know, online retailers try to do this and essentially end up blowing up, because they've effectively let that accounts payable become too large a number. So it's, again, a business model companies seem to have adopted, which means that when you value these companies, you can't view the negative as something that will disappear. You might have to build it into the valuation. So, you know, a little later in this class, we're going to value Amazon, Cisco, and Motorola. And this is from a very old valuation. They all, so if you look at Amazon, it had, you know, they all had working capital be negative. So the change in working capital is negative. In the case of Amazon, it had been negative for a long time. In the case of Motorola, it was just an aberration. That 1 year, their negative change in working capital had become negative. So in the case of Motorola, when I did my valuation, I reverted back to what I thought was something more reasonable. I said, last year was an aberration. Starting next year, when I compute the working capital, I'm going to assume they can go back to 8.23% of revenue. So you'd have seen positive working capital become a drain in cash flows again. For Amazon, I did assume in 99 that eventually they would have to start to carry inventory. I was wrong in hindsight, because you know how Amazon has evaded this issue as they become larger and larger? Now Amazon was at $200 billion revenues, because they've increasingly become an outlet for other people retailing, right? Because if you buy something from Amazon, you're actually not buying it from Amazon about two-thirds of the time. You're buying it from somebody else, and somebody else is just using the Amazon platform, which means Amazon doesn't have any inventory. They can continue to grow using a model where working capital is either zero or negative. But in 1999, I thought of them as an online retailer, traditional retailer. I did push their working capital up, but I didn't push it back to up what a typical, you know. One of the things I report on my website is industry averages for working capital ratios, accounts receivable, inventory. And the reason I put that up is when you sit down to value a company and you see those numbers, your first reaction is that high, is that low? This will at least give you a frame of reference when you make your judgment. So working capital, be careful about your definition. If you have negative working capital, don't freak out. It's not that uncommon now. It can happen. It's not going to kill your valuation. If it's part of the business model, leave it negative. If it's an aberration, replace it with a positive number, either using an industry average or the company's own past. But move on. This is not the place where you want to make your last stand. It's not going to determine whether your valuation is good. Move on to what's, you know, much more critical elements. Any other questions on working capital? Let's talk about cash flows to equity. Now, the strict definition of cash flow to equity is the check you get from the company, the dividends you receive every year. You might use a slightly broader definition, say, I'm going to count dividends and buybacks. But there's an argument to be made that you shouldn't be trusting what companies pay out. You should be looking at what they could have paid out. If you remember your corporate finance, we know that companies don't always pay out what they can afford to in dividends. More often than not, they hold back cash. Why? Because managers are conservative. They're waiting for, it could be that they're setting aside money for a bad year or a bad period. It could just be that they like holding cash because they control the cash. Which also means that when you're valuing a company, if you focus just on dividends, you might end up undervaluing the company. So to give a sense of what those potential dividends are, let's first dismiss bad ways of computing, or look at the bad ways of computing potential dividends. I've actually seen analysts value a company by discounting earnings. And their argument is, potentially, you could pay your earnings out as dividends. That's technically true, right? But if you pay your entire earnings out as dividends, what growth rate should I give you as a company? I should give you zero growth rate. So if you want to use a 3 or a 5 or a 7% growth rate, you definitely can't discount earnings back as a company. So that's not going to work. Okay? And even if earnings were cash flows, if a company, you can argue that accounting earnings are not cash flows, then you're not even measuring the cash flow. So if you want to compute potential dividends, you basically have to do it yourself. And it's really not difficult to do. You know what potential dividends are? It's what's left in the till at the end of the year after you've met every conceivable need. CapEx, working capital, debt payments. Think of yourself as the owner of a business and think about all the checks you have to write. And after you've written all the checks, you look at your bank account and what's left you can take out of the business. That's your free cash flow equity, a potential dividend. So I'll start with the easy definition of, I'll start with the full definition of free cash flow equity and I'll give you a shortcut. You've seen this in your corporate finance, so it should be reviewed. To compute the free cash flow equity, here's what I do. I start with net income, as opposed to what when I did free cash flow to the firm. There I start with after-tax operating income. Here I start with net income. I subtract out net capex and change in working capital, and everything we said about net capex and change in working capital in a free cash flow to the firm setting applies here as well. I'm going to count acquisitions. I'm going to count R&D. I'm going to look at non-cash current assets minus non-debt current liabilities. And then, and this is what's new when you do free cash flow equity, I'm going to look at cash outflows because I have to repay some debt and cash inflows that come from the fact that I might borrow new money. So the net amount is what I'm basically going to have to pay. So if I borrow $80 million and I pay back $100 million, net I have to come up with $20 million. That becomes a loss line item. And what I get at the end is the free cash flow equity. So that is the full calculation. If you take a look at every item in the free cash flow equity, it's going to be in the statement of cash flows, right? Every item there. Because the net capex will be under investing, the working capital will be under operating, and the debt repayments and new debt taken on will be under financing cash flows. So getting free cash flow equity is not difficult for last year. If you have to make projections of these numbers, though, it gets messy. The first three line items you can make projections on, but if you think about projecting out how much debt you'll have to repay and how much new debt you will have to take on in next year, 2 years from now, 3 years, you're very quickly going to drive yourself crazy. Sometimes you might have no choice. If you do an LBO, you have to be explicit about how much debt you repay each year. But if you're looking at a company, you say, how do I do that? So I'll give you a shortcut. And this is, again, a shortcut you saw in corporate finance. If you're willing to make the assumption that starting today, a portion of your net capex and change in working capital is going to come from debt, 20%, 30%. And the rest is going to come from equity. The shortcut is to free cash flow equity is to start with net income. Look at the portion of your net capex that comes from equity and the portion of your working capital change that comes from equity. And what you're left with is the free cash flow equity. This works only if that debt ratio is stable and you know what it's going to be over time. So again, you're staying equity focused. You're trying to estimate the free cash flow equity. So I'm going to use an example, and this example should be a familiar one for those of you in my corporate finance class. And that's, incidentally, if you want to do this in the statement of cash flows, as I said, all the numbers, take your company and try it out. But the numbers you're going to get are going to be different for almost every company. So this is a table that I updated at the start of 2020 where I computed collectively the dividends paid across all companies by region and collectively the free cash flows equity. And if this table is true, there's a messy game going on. The collective free cash flow equity is about $605 billion across the world. The collective cash returned in dividends is about $1.66 billion. You add the buybacks, got about a $2 billion difference to explain, but this is before debt. So tells you something about how companies were affording to pay the dividends and the buybacks that they did. We'll come back and re-examine this, but it's kind of a big picture of dividends and of how dividends and free cash flow equity can be very different for most companies. Ready? So here's my example. It's Disney, as you know, our company in corporate finance. And this is from way back in time, in 1997. The net income was $1,533 million. CapEx was $1,746 million. Depreciation was, it says per share. Cross out the per share. It's clearly not per share. $1,134 million. Working capital increased by $477 million during the year. And they were, their debt ratio was about 24%. So I'm going to use the shortcut to compute the free cash flow equity. There's the net income. If you take the net CapEx, $612 million times 1 minus the debt ratio, you come up with $466 million. You take the change in working capital times 1 minus the debt ratio. So basically, you're looking at only the equity portion of this investment. You end up with a free cash flow equity of $704 million. Their actual dividends were $345 million. Already, you can see that if I value Disney with a dividend discount model and use the $345 million as my cash flow, I'm going to undervalue the company because its free cash flow equity is much higher. So now, I'm going to play a little game. If you look at what drives that free cash flow equity, it's what my debt ratio is, right? So if I use 24% debt, I've got to come up with 76%. If I use 40% debt, I have to come up with only 60%. If I use 80% debt, I have to come up with only 20%. So here's what I did. I basically kept everything in the equation right. So this is not about changing the debt on the existing project, but on new investments. Let's say I switch increasingly to using more and more debt. Look at what happens to my free cash flow equity. As I go from 0% debt to 90% debt, my free cash flow equity goes through the roof. This looks like an easy way to make your equity value go up, right? Because by using more debt on your new investments, you have to use less equity. If you have to use less equity, you have a higher free cash flow equity. So what am I missing here? Because there must be something. Because if this is true, then every company should be using more and more debt to fund projects. What do I discount the free cash flow equity at? The cost of equity. And what drives the cost of equity? Risk-free rates and equity risk premiums, but everybody faces that. To beta. How do we come up with betas? We start with the unlevered beta of the business where you're in, and then we apply a debt-to-equity ratio. You see the other shoe waiting to drop? Using more debt will make your free cash flow equity higher. But using more debt will also lead to a higher beta and a higher cost of equity. So that's a trade-off, right? So if I use more debt, my cash flows are going to be higher. If I use more debt, my cost of equity is going to be higher. So I'm going to kind of bring them together, and I'm going to ask you for an opinion. So the good side of debt is it makes my free cash flow equity higher, my return equity higher. And we'll talk about the return equity effect. The bad side of debt is it makes my beta higher and my cost of equity higher. So I'm going to read a few statements to you, and you tell me which one of these you buy into. Here's the first one. Increasing leverage will always increase value because the cash flow effects will dominate the discount rate effects. Why can't that be true? If that were true, what would the optimal debt ratio for every company be? 99.99% debt, right? And we know that's crazy. Maybe it's the second statement. Increasing leverage will always decrease value because the risk effects will be greater than the cash flow effects. Why can't that be true? Because if that were true, the optimal debt ratio for every company is never borrow money. How about this statement? Increasing leverage will not affect value because the risk effect will exactly offset the cash flow effect. It's nothing to do with it. Efficient markets are only a side story here. This is corporate finance's most famous theorem, right? What am I just, in C, what am I saying? My value is going to be the same no matter what data, which is the Miller-Modigliani theorem, right? And what allows the Miller-Modigliani theorem to be sustained is you have no tax, you basically have no taxes and no default risk. Borrowing money will have no effect because it, you can see it's a special case. Which means that it can't be A, it can't be B, it can't be C, because with C, it doesn't matter how much you borrow, it's irrelevant. How can it not be all three? Because they kind of cover the spectrum. Depends on your company. For some companies, increasing debt will increase value. The cash flow effect will dominate the risk effect. Those are underlevered companies. For some companies, increasing debt will lower value. Those are the overlevered companies. For some companies, increasing debt will do little for value because you're already at your optimal. It's a different way of doing optimal capital structure by focusing on free cash flow equity and cost of equity. If you remember the way we did this in corporate finance, how do we do this? Come up with the optimal debt ratio. Come on, you remember. We looked at the cost of capital, and we looked at the minimum cost of capital, right? Wherever the cost of capital is minimized. This is just a different framework for arriving at the same conclusion. So that's basically all I have to say about cash flows. Any questions about cash flows? Don't close your books. We're not done yet. No, we have time. So let's talk about growth, right? Growth, for some reason, is glorified. It's glorified in case studies. It's glorified in business school. It's glorified in movies. And the general consensus you get, if you ask a company, do you want to grow or shrink? The answer with every company is, hey, we'd like to grow. But growth is kind of a mixed blessing. The good side of growth is it allows small revenues. It allows you to scale up, become larger. That's a good side. Revenues become larger. Income gets larger. The bad side of growth is for that to be done, you got to reinvest money, which drains your cash flows. The effect of growth and value will depend on which side dominates. A little later in this class, I'm going to show you what the world looks like in terms of the value of growth, and it's kind of a scary place in terms of how many companies destroy value as they grow, but that's a trade-off. So when we talk about growth rates, we have to keep that in mind. Increasing the growth rate for your company doesn't always show up as higher value. It might sometimes lower value if you're careful about building in all the factors. So let's talk about the three generic ways you can estimate the future. The first is you can look at the past and extrapolate. You can look at historical growth in earnings, revenues, etc. We'll start with that because that's going to be, for some of you with taking companies with a long history, you can say, look, I can see what my company grew at. Why do I need to get ambitious? Why don't I just extrapolate past growth? Second, we can outsource it. In other words, we can ask somebody else what the growth rate is going to be. Many of you valuing companies that are tracked by analysts will find a growth rate for your company online for the future, because many of your companies have analyst forecasts of growth. We'll talk about why it's so dangerous to use that growth rate and what information there might be in that growth rate. The third is to tie growth to your company, to what it does, how much it's reinvesting, how well it's reinvesting. And my biases already are towards three, but I want to look at the first two approaches. Let's start with historical growth. When people talk about the historical growth rate, they act like it's a fact. But it's really not a fact because it depends on how you compute your growth rate. It sounds like inside statistics, but the number you get can be very different depending on whether you use arithmetic averages or geometric averages. It can depend. Sometimes people get fancy and use regression models, and you can get a different growth rate. It can also depend on your starting and your ending point. If you pick a really bad year as your base year and you look at the ending point, your growth rate's always going to be much better. It's also going to depend on the metric you use, growth in revenues, operating income, net income, earnings per share. And finally, growth rates can get really tricky when you have a small company that's become big and you're extrapolating the future, or when you have a negative earnings company become a positive earnings company. So nothing fancy here, but I want to kind of hit these points because sometimes they get lost in the numbers. So again, an old calculation, Motorola, I computed growth rates in three separate numbers, revenue, EBITDA, and EBIT. Okay? So I had 6 years of numbers. I computed the percentage change each year. And then I computed an arithmetic average, which basically means I add the five numbers up, divide by five. So the revenue growth rate is 7%. The EBITDA growth rate is 10.89%. But the EBIT growth rate is 42.45%. Focus on the EBIT growth because you're already going to see why arithmetic average growth rates are so deceptive. So what am I saying? Great period, right? 42.45% growth a year. But if you look at my EBIT, it went from 2.6 billion to 3.2 billion over the entire five-year period. That's like a 20% growth over the five. You're saying, how the hell did you take a 20% growth over 5 years and make it 42% a year? Well, mathematically, you can see how I got there, right? Because my numbers jumped around, I ended up with this huge jump in year five, and arithmetic average growth rate is going to get skewed any time you have big outliers. So the alternative to arithmetic average is a geometric average. And to compute a geometric average growth rate, all I need is my starting number and my ending number. I can ignore the middle numbers. So if I take 30.93 and 22.245 and look at the compounded average growth rate, I get up 6.82% in revenues. I get 5.39% in EBITDA and 4.31% in EBIT. Now I'm getting a little closer to the truth. This is going to be true for any data series. If you compare an arithmetic average and a geometric average, the numbers are usually going to be different, except for in one scenario. What has to be true about your growth rates per year for your arithmetic average and your geometric average to converge? They have to be constant. In other words, if I have 8% growth in year one, 8% growth in year two, 8% in year three, 8% in year four, 8% in year five, then my arithmetic average and my geometric average are going to give me the same number. The more volatility there is in year-to-year numbers, the bigger the divergence between the two. This is why when you do revenue growth rates, you tend to get closer numbers for arithmetic and geometric than you do EBITDA or EBIT or earnings per share. Because as you go further and further down the income statement, things start to get more volatile. So one of the things you have to be careful about is if you're using a service, Capital IQ, for instance, reports a growth rate. And they're pretty careful. They report what's called a CAGR, a compounded annual growth rate, which is a geometric average. But there are other services that are not as precise. So you go to Yahoo Finance and just say growth rate over the last 5 years. You have no idea whether it's an arithmetic or a geometric average. So do it yourself. This isn't rocket science. You don't need somebody to do it for you. At least that way you know what you've actually computed over time. So your growth rates can vary depending on arithmetic versus geometric. I would trust the geometric more. It'll vary depending on which metric you look at. Okay? And that's going to come back to play a role in when you look up a growth rate for your company, what metric is that growth rate in? Now let's talk about those tricky cases. So this is from way back in time. Time Warner had an LBO, it was losing money. So they went from having minus 0.05% a share to 25 cents a share. So they were minus point. So let me start with a very intuitive question. If you go from losing 5 cents a share to making 25 cents a share, is that a good year or a bad year? That sounds like a good year to me, right? We went from negative to positive. Now let me ask you to compute a growth rate on what happened that year. How do we compute growth rates? We take the change in earnings, which in this case means minus 5 to plus 25, 30 cents, and then we divide by the earnings per share in the last year, which is minus 0.05. So if I do that mathematically, you know what I'm going to end up with as a growth rate? I'm going to hit minus 600%, which makes absolutely no sense, right? You went for, so because it makes no sense, you know what some people do? They take the minus and they put a line down, so what's the big deal, plus? They call it, they can create an app, in Excel, you can create this as a function, right? Absolute value, and then you walk away saying, no, it just looks better. Of course, it means completely nothing because you know it's arbitrarily replaced. The second is, what's causing you to have a negative number here? It's not what's in the numerator, it's what's in the denominator, right? Do you know what some analysts do? They take the higher of the two numbers. So in this case, so dividing by minus 0.05, they divide by plus point, something you're not supposed to do when you do growth rates, but at least you're getting a number, so you get 120%. If you have a company where the earnings are going from negative to positive, you know what your growth rate truly is? It's NMF. What's NMF? It's not meaningful. It's better not to compute a growth rate, because once you compute a growth rate, what are you tempted to do? Use it to project the future. It's better to say, I don't know what the growth rate is because I've gone from negative to positive. I can give you all kinds of mathematical rules. Use the max, use the absolute. But they're all meaningless because a growth rate's when you get a negative to a positive number, it's basically meaningless. I've seen people actually use regressions to get around it. The bottom line is, whatever approach you use, the growth rate is not meaningful as a predictor for the future. So if you have any companies, and you're, you know, if you're doing a company, negative to positive, and ask you what's the historical growth rate, say, I don't know. It's okay, though. You can still value a company because you're perfectly okay without a historical growth rate. Here's another thing to worry about. Some of you have companies that are now successful companies, but 5 years ago, they used to be small companies. This is, again, a throwback in time to a company called Callaway Golf. You know what their most famous product was? A golf club called the Big Bertha. And when it came out in 1992, they were this tiny company, 1.8 million net profit. And over the next 5 years, they grew incredibly. In fact, if you take the compounded average growth rate, not even the arithmetic average, the geometric average growth rate over this five-year period was 102% a year. So you're sitting down valuing Callaway Golf. in 96. And he said, look, they've grown 102% in the last 5 years. I'm going to use that 102% as my growth rate for the next 5 years. Let's see what's going to happen to Callaway Golf. It's going to go from 122 to 4.11 billion. You know the story you'd have to tell about Callaway Golf for this to be true? Every person in the U.S. will have to own a Big Bertha, even if you don't play golf, maybe as a weapon or whatever else you want to use it on. Could I tell a story? Maybe, but it'd be a very implausible story because why would you walk around with a golf club if you're never going to get on a golf course? But this is what happens when you take historical growth rates and just extrapolate them. So I'll tell you my views on historical growth. It's nice to know it, but I almost never use it. And I, you know, to add that caution, about 30 years ago, there was this guy from the UK who came over to the US to do a thesis in economics. His name was IMD Little. His name was actually Little, and the initials were IMD. Shows up at Harvard, Princeton, wherever he went. He did a thesis on, and his thesis was, can I use past growth to predict future growth? So he actually took 10 years of data. In those days, you had to collect the data by hand. He took 10 years of data on US companies. He computed the growth rate from 1951 through 55 in earnings and the growth rate from 56 through 60. So you have, for every company, has two growth rates, 51 through 55, 56 through 60. And what's he trying to test? Whether knowing the growth rate of the first period is going to help you predict the growth rate of the second period. His research was actually much more detailed, but put simply, here's what he did. He computed a correlation between those two growth rates. So let me ask you a question. If past growth is very good at predicting future growth, what kind of correlation should you expect to see? Positive or negative? Let's get that out of the way first. It should be very positive. It should be a high number. Closer to one, the better. Because then, if you have high growth rate in the past, you can predict high growth rates in the future. So if growth carries over, you'd want a high positive correlation. Almost as good, if you're a predictor, would be a high negative correlation. Why? Because if you get a high negative correlation, what the data is telling you, if you have a high growth rate in the past, you get a low growth rate. So when you do the projections, you can use that. What's the worst possible scenario if you've been using historical growth rate in prediction in terms of a correlation? Okay. It's a correlation close to zero, right? Because then there's no... I won't tell you what this researcher found, but I'll give you the title of his thesis and it'll kind of give away what he found. The title of his thesis is called, was Higgledy Piggledy Growth. It's like a children's book you're looking at, right? Higgledy Piggledy, and trust the British to come up with really creative names, right? Higgledy Piggledy Growth. He found basically no relationship. I have to give him credit. That name sticks in my head. I can't even remember my own dissertation. No, but I remember Higgledy Piggledy Growth. So when you look at past growth and you're freaking out, remember, Higgledy Piggledy Growth. You don't get past growth, just let it go. I'm going to leave you with one final page, and we'll come back on Wednesday after. Remember, there is class after the quiz, so don't flee after the quiz. Come back here. We're going to talk about growth rates. We're going to talk about analyst projections of growth. In fact, I'm going to give you a task to do, and it'll take you only a minute or two. Do it even though you're preparing for the quiz. Whatever company you're valuing, go on to Yahoo Finance or any online source and try to get an analyst estimate of growth for your company for the future. And you should be able to find it for most of your companies. Bring that growth rate in, because on Wednesday we're going to talk about analyst estimates of growth and how much they should play a role in how you value the company. Okay, so I'll see you on Wednesday.
How do you get the market? started the book then. But remember for Embraer, last session, I computed market value by taking the book debt, the interest expense, and using the interest rate on the debt. Go back and review that slide, because it gives you a simple way to compute book debt to market. It's the present value equation, right? It's like pricing a bond. Hi, how are you?
I was supposed to email you earlier about the lambda thing.
Okay.
But I think I got that figure out.
Okay,
I
so just you shouldn't have a lambda and a beta in the same calculation. Yeah. There isn't a scenario where both will show up.
Right.
No, and if you don't have the information to compute a lambda, just don't use lambda at all.
Right. I would just use
Just use the weighted average.
And one minus the 30%, right? So I have another question. So we actually have, in our group, we actually have one person drop out of the class, and that person used to cover the international companies, and each other person already cover its others. So
That's okay. That
okay. Yeah, I was like, we started already. Who is going to pick that?
Yeah. Why is it
Hey, how are you?
Hi, Professor.
Hey.
So I'm getting a little frightened of coronavirus stuff.
Oh, you should be. Oh, you mean coming to New York City?
Yeah, I don't have great lungs, so I know it's.
So, what do you plan to do?
So, I'm planning to. I'm from the Boston area.
Mm-hmm.
We have kind of like an isolated summer home. It's sort of off.
So, can you do things online? Totally. Do you have Wi-Fi connection?
I'm hoping to.
So what will happen is I'll email you the quiz just as I'm coming down here. It's 5 minutes before the quiz, and you'll have 35 minutes, so you need an extra 5 minutes for printing off the quiz and doing whatever. So I'll give you the extra 5 minutes for setup, and at 35 minutes later, just email the quiz back with the solutions.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can take pictures of your phone and just send the pictures back.
Perfect, thank you. So I'm in this class and for finance with you.
Yeah.
So I'll let you know when I finalize my own plans.
Completely understand.